Welcome to Horror 101, a special series celebrating some of the most influential films from the horror genre. Tonight, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. We begin with John Kenneth Muir, an accomplished author and critic, and one of our favorite guests. You can check out his library of books on films of all genres at johnkennethmuir.com and read his enlightening criticism at reflectionsonfilmandtelevision.blogspot.com. The one movie-going experience that I wish I could have had, obviously it was before I was born, but was the opening of Psycho, because it was something so new and unexpected. I would have loved to have been in that theater and felt that reaction. How in your view, was Psycho a game changer?
Well, I first want to say I agree, Jamie, with what you said. I have often wished that I could have been part of that first generation of Psycho viewers, because Norman Bates and his dressing habits, let's say, so quickly moved into the realm of the pop culture and the late night talk shows and monologues and all that, and moved so quickly that even if you hadn't seen the film, Norman Bates and Mother kind of became shorthand, culturally speaking. Mm-hmm. But imagine what it would have been like to see that film for the first time, seeing it as Alfred Hitchcock intended, without knowing anything that was going to happen. You had to come in, when the movie started, and you couldn't tell anybody the ending. Just imagine what that would have been like. What a game changer that would have been. And I think that even though later generations deeply, deeply admire Psycho, as I do, and I can very happily appreciate the film and point intellectually to all the ways that it shatters decorum, there's in some sense a feeling after so many generations that you sort of know what Psycho's about, even if you haven't seen it, mm-hmm. which is a little sad to me because it's such a powerful film. I don't think that it retains some of its power. It retains all of its power. It has much power, but it doesn't retain all of its power, because we kind of know what it's about, even if we haven't seen it. And I find that a little sad, because it's so brilliantly orchestrated and executed. Hitchcock just did a magnificent job with it. And you think, wow, I wish this could really affect somebody. I don't know, maybe it'll go out of the public consciousness, and then you can like really experience it again. But I don't know about you, but when I watch the film, I have to put myself in that mindset of, it's almost like I'm doing a Jedi mind trick on myself. I don't know what's going to happen. How would I react were this the first time I've seen it? You know what I mean? You have to sort of have that focus with it to do that, because you kind of know its tricks, unfortunately, at this point. I think as far as what Hitchcock did, which is really amazing, is that he made in Psycho essentially an independent film inside the studio system. And mm-hmm. I think that's why it shatters decorum and movie traditions in the way it does. I mean, of course, it was based on a novel by Robert Bloch, right? And, Alfred Hitchcock basically financed the film, I guess. He filmed at Universal and Review Studios. He used the people, the technicians who were making his show, his anthology, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, mm-hmm. On a regular basis. He took that crew. And that was a real vote of confidence, I think, for television very early on, when a lot of people weren't viewing television as an art form, that Hitchcock took his TV people and made this movie that he wanted to make. And he shot it in black and white, which made it cheaper. When everybody else was saying color, 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 he made it in black and white. Mm-hmm. And he also, I guess, took a big cut in his own salary to make the film. So it was clear he was calling the shot and making the film the way he wanted to make it, because Universal Studios didn't really want to make this film. They felt the source material was sort of unsavory in the
yes.
book. That, which of course it is, but that doesn't mean it's not fun. That doesn't mean people won't want to see it. So Hitchcock really almost treated this sort of like an independent film. Interfacing at points with the studio system, having stars in it like Janet Leigh and Anthony Perkins, but then he did his own thing, and I think that's really amazing. And I think the fact that he didn't have so much studio interference is what enabled him to shatter so many movie taboos and so many movie conventions in Psycho. the things that he did were, you know, just revolutionary at that time. Today they've been imitated so often that it's almost hard to see how revolutionary it was, but it really is a revolutionary film.
I think what's also something that set Psycho apart is that it's one of the first times that the quote-unquote villain of the piece, the monster of the piece, isn't the universal monster, you know, that we were used to seeing at that time. I mean, this is the boy next door. This is the charming guy that couldn't possibly have any of those tendencies. Because I think it's coming off of the 50s, when, you know, movies like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and others dealt with the threat of communism. You had the communist could be next door. That threat there. Is that an expansion of that, do you think, in Psycho?
Well, that it's very interesting. I think that what we saw, you know, through the 30s and 40s and 50s were these very coded reflections of things. The monsters represented cultural issues, just like you said, the aliens and the body snatchers representing communism or perhaps McCarthyism, depending on who you talk to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they were metaphors for larger things. For the outsider, for, you know, the derided other, you know, all these things that they could be representing, you know, with specific ideologies like communism or far-right reactionaryism, things like that. And I think as we moved into the 60s, there was the feeling a little bit of moving away from artifice towards more naturalistic films, although Psycho is very artificial. It is still very expressionistic. Today we wouldn't consider it naturalistic, but it is much more naturalistic than the films of the 30s and 40s comparatively. And I think that what you had there were two things. It was that you didn't have to code so much for what you were doing. You were able to say the monster is here and the monster is us without having to make it Frankenstein, the Frankenstein monster or a vampire, things like that. I think you were able to do it with less coding, with less distance, and know that the audience would accept that based on things that had happened in the culture, like the Ed Gein case in Wisconsin in the 1950s. But the other thing I think that was happening at the time, and you see this with films like The Bad Seed in the 1950s, was this idea really taking hold in America about psychology. Pop psychology and psychology were becoming huge things in the American culture in the late 50s and early 60s, and coded in the study of behavioral psychology, nurture versus nurture, things like that. That became very popular at that time, and Psycho certainly plays on that context, the idea of psychology playing an important role in the film, and even the nature versus nurture argument. I mean, you can't argue two things about Norman Bates. One, that he is an incredibly sweet and seemingly gentle boy, and two, that he's a brutal murderer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what is that? Well, maybe by nature, he was an extremely kind and sensitive person. And through the terrible nurture of being with his mother, he became this monster. And again, that's asking us to broach the ideas of psychology that were just roiling in the culture at that point, in the popular culture. So, I think that's where you're getting with the idea of the human being the monster, rather than a monster being a monster, if that makes sense.
Robert Galuzzo is the director of a terrific new documentary titled The Psycho Legacy, which explores the original Hitchcock classic and the sequels as well, with invaluable insights from the key creative talents who brought them all to life. The film is now available on DVD and can be purchased here from our homepage.
Good evening. I think it would be interesting to talk about fear.
I still think Psycho is the scariest movie ever made.
A lot of people think I'm a monster.
It's dangerous to put trust in a filmmaker like Hitchcock.
Psycho wouldn't have been as effective and as brilliant if it wasn't for Anthony Perkins.
Tony had a tortured quality to him as a human being.
When an actor gets a role that fits that inner personality that's there and brings that out, that's unique.
I mean, the story about how they didn't do that until he was really, should have gone free. I like that.
For Psycho 2, I mean, it's got big shoes to fill.
How in God's name are we going to be worthy of our predecessor?
Anthony Perkins makes us believe the guy viciously murdered two people in that first movie is safe, then we can come into his house and nothing will happen to us. Right.
Very intense. I remember sitting in the room with him and everybody had left the room and he just sort of stared and got and locked eyes with me for a long period and I thought...
He stands there and he's got the shovel and she's just taking a little sip and wham!
Even in movies that pride themselves on being so depraved and so out there, you don't hit an old lady with a shovel.
He was evil.
There is no God!
He put me in an ice chest with real ice. Closes the lid. That's why I look blue and dead.
You'd still tell on Mother and no one must know about her or what she's done! Mother!
Well, I mean, going back to the beginning, I mean, if you go back about 4 years ago, we were kind of at a point where I think, if I recall correctly, Universal had put out Psycho 2 and 3 on DVD, and neither of them had any special features. It was just like the trailer or whatever. And this was also around the same time that Friday the 13th was getting a box set, Nightmare on Elm Street already had a box set. Mm-hmm. It seemed like all the other famous horror franchises were getting kind of the special edition treatment. And I didn't really understand why Psycho, the granddaddy of them all, never really got, you know, much love besides the first movie, which, of course, is a classic. So, of course, everyone's going to analyze and hold the first one up to these high standards. But I grew up, you know, I grew up in the 80s, and I grew up on the sequels. Those were the ones that I would always catch on cable mm-hmm. that I fell in love with. And the more I searched online, I realized there's really no information about the making of the sequels in particular. So part of it was just my own will. I wanted to know. I wanted to know how those other movies were made and how they kind of fell into place with the original.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody involved in the sequels obviously had a great deal of respect and admiration for Hitchcock in the first film.
Right.
And they were getting their start on Psycho movies and went on to do really great things within the genre and outside of the genre. Mm-hmm. Somebody like Tom Holland wrote Psycho 2 as his first big writing gig, and I mean, he went to do Fright Night, Child's Play, some Stephen King stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Mick Garris, you know, that was Psycho 4 was his second movie, he created
right.
Masters of Horror. So I just thought it was interesting that, like, a lot of these great people that are making films and things that I watch now that I love got their start in a Psycho movie. It all seemed interesting to me and worth documenting, or at least digging into and finding out about. So
yeah.
That was kind of the genesis of the idea, and the first person I reached out to was Richard Franklin, the director of Psycho 2, who I communicated with via email. And he was just really sweet and really nice and supportive of the idea because he really loved and, you know, had a special place in his heart for Psycho 2. And I think he deserved a little bit more credit for what they did on that sequel as well. So he was, you know, he was very supportive in the beginning, and whether he knew it or not, he got me started because he was in Australia, so I couldn't get to him directly other than email. But he put me in touch with Tom Holland, who wrote Psycho 2, and that really got the ball rolling. Once I got
mm-hmm.
to Tom got me in touch with Mick. Mick got me in touch with KK. And before I knew it, we were, like, off and running. So,
wow. And this does, as you say, it does definitely cover the sequels in depth. Do you think the lack of behind-the-scenes stuff on the sequels has to do with the fact that, unlike a lot of the horror series, I mean, Psycho is, undisputably, it's the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
So kind of any sequel to that film is almost looked down upon. But do you find that perception changing over the years?
I think so because, you know, look, the original is a classic. Nobody can argue that, even just cinema fans in general.
Right.
So any sequel to a classic will always be looked at as sort of a footnote. But the thing that I found interesting, and this is kind of the reason that a lot of the younger filmmakers are in the Psycho legacy, is because these are all guys that I'm friends with that are my age that
mm-hmm.
are all making horror movies now. And I just discovered, you know, we'd be hanging out having beers and we'd get into these lengthy conversations about the stuff they talk about in the doc. Like, that's the reason they're there is because they're me. They're my voice talking
mm-hmm.
about how cool this sequence was or how cool it was that Perkins directed three and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, if you compare it to other film series like Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween, I'm a huge fan of all those, but even diehard fans will tell you there's at least one or two that they don't like or that are like, oh, they jumped the shark with that one.
Right.
Psycho is considerably all good movies. I think all four of them are pretty good. So I think it's interesting that A, it's a series that's consistently good and that has their lead character in all four episodes.
Right.
Not to mention, I think it's the first time in movie history that a lead character reprised a role 22 years after the original. I mean, nowadays they just remake it, but
yeah, they remake it.
That was cool. Yeah,
they use digital imaging.
Yeah.
I want to add something because you bring up this is very important. I didn't really, you know, until the internet, and especially not until really this century. You know, you're doing a very good service here because I did not realize the Psycho sequels were held in such high regard. And it is a revelation because I think, like a lot of us, I remember the Psycho 2 review on At the Movies by Siskel and Ebert, and it wasn't very flattering at the time. I don't know if that's changed with Ebert or not, but I remember Gene Siskel was just like, I hated it. But, that was kind of like before the internet. But then you get the internet and you have these communities, these film communities develop over the years, and you realize, wow, that 2 and 3 are held in very high regard that you wouldn't really expect. And it's an eye-opening experience. So I think your documentary can only do good.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. But also, it's funny that you mentioned that because the original Psycho got some of the worst reviews of Hitchcock's career.
That's true. You're right.
You know, I mean, nobody... I think a lot of critics were pissed off that they had to wait to see it. They couldn't get a quote-unquote press screening. They had to go see it with the general audience. And I don't know if they held, because everyone declared it like the worst movie that Hitchcock ever made, yet a year later it was all on their top 10 list of the year. I mean, this is stuff that I learned from the guys that made Psycho 2, because obviously they went into the vault and pulled out all those original reviews for Psycho. And they were surprised because they remember seeing it as kids and loving it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know, sometimes critical acclaim doesn't mean anything.
Tell me, in your opinion, the appeal of Norman Bates and what makes him kind of cut from a different cloth from these other horror genre, quote-unquote, villains.
Right. There's a few things. I mean, one, I think there's a term, and I think we even use it in the opening narration, but I love that he's referred to as the Hamlet of horror. He's got this... The character itself has this very kind of Shakespearean tragedy element to it. Like, no matter, he seems like he's a decent person, but no matter how hard he tries, he's just bound to have these terrible things following him because he's got this personality of his mother. The reason I like all four Psycho movies and I think why people hold them in higher regard is because Freddy and Jason and all these characters, they have kind of a fantastic element to them. I mean, I love them, but... they're not really based in reality where there's nothing in any four of the Psycho films that couldn't happen. I think they're all pretty reality based, and it's like Norman Bates could be a dude that exists. Like, it's totally possible. So I think people are always fascinated by anything that could happen, by true crime. Right now the most popular shows are things like true crime shows, like, CSI, Criminal Minds, NCIS, all that kind of stuff.
Law and Order.
Yeah, Law and Order. I mean, so that's the thing. It's like people are always fascinated by things that are real, and they want to kind of break down the psychology of things. And, I mean, if you go back to 1960, it must have blown people's minds to be like, whoa, that dude dressed up like his mother? Because you're like, that to me was always, as a kid, I was just so intrigued by that character. I mean, it's one of the greatest performances on film ever. I mean, Anthony Perkins in the first Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think makes the sequels really great is you've got this amazing actor that, whether he wanted it or not, was born to play that role. And, what's funny is in the documentary, I had an idea of what I wanted it to be when I started. And then once we started cutting it together, inadvertently, I didn't mean it to turn out this way, but somewhere by the midway point, it actually morphs into a documentary more about Anthony Perkins as Norman Bates and kind of coming to terms with the fact that, yeah, that's who he's going to always be remembered as.
So tell me about some of the most memorable interview experiences that you had putting this film together.
The whole thing was an adventure. So I know this sounds cliche, but I really do have a story and memory regarding each and every single one of them. When you do something for several years, you kind of have the time to relish in all those experiences. But I think the one that I constantly bring up is Jeff Fahey, who is just so amazing and so nice.
Mm-hmm.
And that came together in a very weird, serendipitous way. You know, at the time, this is going back a few years, but at the time he was living in Afghanistan. He may still live there. I'm not exactly sure. He was doing some kind of charity work or building, I don't know, building hospitals in Afghanistan or something like that, which I just thought was so interesting and bizarre at the same time. But he was going to be in town briefly for Grindhouse. He was promoting the Tarantino Rodriguez movie.
Right.
And he was going to be swinging through New Jersey for a convention appearance. I lived in New York at the time. So I had kind of made the pilgrimage to this convention with the hope that I'd snag an interview with him, like, in a hotel room or whatever. There's a little bit of miscommunication from his agent or whatever at the time. So he had no idea I was coming to this thing, and I got there, and it was kind of a little, I don't know if you've been to a convention, but after out on a convention, it's like it's a madhouse in the lobby because everyone's just hanging out and drinking and doing their thing. So it was a very, like, kind of hectic scenario, and it seemed, like, impossible to set anything up. But I just went up to him and explained who I was and said, this is a labor of love. It's not Universal is not commissioning this. This is something I'm doing on my own. It'd mean the world to me if you'd talk to me about Psycho 3. And he was just so nice about it. He's like, I'm hanging with friends now, but I'm going to see my family in New York in, like, 2 days. So, why don't you give me your number, and I'll just come over on Monday. And to his word, like 2 days later, I was at my cameraman's apartment in the city, and he just came there with his sister and sat down with us for an hour to chit-chat. And it was great because it came together so fast, he legitimately had not thought about Psycho 3 for like 20 years. So you can kind of see him reminiscing on screen. Like he's remembering things for the first time while we're talking to him. And it's a little more evident in the extended interviews because I left a lot of the kind of candid banter back and forth. But I just thought his interview was kind of magical because it came together against all odds, and it was interesting for him to reflect back on it. And he gave me some great stories. One that he gave me that's not – I didn't have the camera rolling, but when we were just kind of chit-chatting before we started, I think he actually said that he auditioned for the remake as the Sam Loomis character, which Viggo Mortensen ended up playing. I'm pretty sure he said he went on that, but he's like, you guys know I was in 3. And I don't think they did. So that's an interesting tidbit that I couldn't fit anywhere because we weren't even recording when he said that.
22 years later, Norman Bates is home. Psycho 2.
It's starting again.
Okay, our next guest is on hold, and we're so excited about this. The Movie Geeks are honored to welcome to the show a multi-talented writer-director who has been the brainchild behind some of horror's most iconic films from the past 25 years, and it all started with a script for the highly anticipated Psycho 2 during the summer of 1983, which saw the return of Norman Bates to the big screen after an absence of 23 years. He's also the man behind Child's Play, which introduced the world to the infamous murdering doll Chucky, and the irresistible vampire film Fright Night, which continues to thrive among new generations of moviegoers. Other films that grace his resume include Fatal Beauty, The Beast Within, The Temp, Thinner, and Cloak and Dagger. And his work in television is equally impressive and includes writing and directing duties on Stephen King's The Langoliers and contributions to both the Tales from the Crypt and Masters of Horror anthology series. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Tom Holland. Mr. Holland, are you there?
Yes, I am, and thank you for the wonderful introduction.
Oh, thank you so much for being with us. I can't thank you enough.
Well, I apologize for being a little bit late.
Are you working? Are you in the middle of a shoot or anything?
Yeah, well, yes, there are a lot of things going on. Yeah, there are.
We've had that with our previous two guests. They've been calling from location, so it's going around tonight. Tell me a little bit about, you've said that Psycho 2 you consider your big break into the industry. Tell me where you were before that came about and how the opportunity did come about for you for Psycho 2.
Let's see if I can give a build up. I've been writing originals through the 70s. I started to get television work in the 70s. I got a movie of the week called The Initiation of Sarah, which I wrote, which at the time was quite notorious. It was recently remade, actually, the only television show I've ever had that's been remade. And it was on ABC, and I think it was the first overtly sort of what they called the jiggle, a TV show. There was a scene in it that was about sorority girls who were witches. And there was a scene in it where the fight carried the girls into the fountain. And they came out with wet T-shirts. And that was...
Wow.
That had to be around 78 or 79. Then I got The Beast Within, which was the first feature that I did. And I thought that was a terrific script, but the movie wasn't a success, and I didn't work for a year after that. Mm-hmm. So, and I think I got Class of 84 before Psycho 2.
Right.
But then I got Psycho 2. And that was the first, certainly wasn't the first job. I'd been a working writer then for a number of years, but it was the first job that turned into an enormous international success.
Well, I would imagine, and just to think of the masterpiece that was Hitchcock's Psycho in 1960.
Yeah.
23 years have passed. This must have been an incredibly daunting project for you.
Daunting, intimidating, terrifying, going into something, expecting the critics to just roast you alive for even attempting it, all of that, yes. It was terrifying. Intimidating,
Yeah, I would imagine. Did they have ideas that they wanted you to flesh out, or did they just give you carte blanche on where to take the story? How did that work?
No, let's see if I can remember. And this is said with a great amount of respect. Robert Block had done a sequel, had written a book that was a sequel. And it didn't work in the sense that it was not a story that used the Norman Bates character the way any of us would have liked to have seen him be used dramatically. It wasn't a commercially satisfying novel. And I say that having an overwhelming respect for Mr. Block, who was the mentor to an awful lot of people, including Stephen King. But his sequel novel did not work. And so it was a tabula rasa in that sense. And the question was how to do a movie that would be faithful to the first one, and yet would use one of the qualities that made Norman so such a stunning characterization by Anthony Perkins, which was that you had a psychopathic serial murderer that you felt sorry for,
right?
You know, that you identified with, that you understood his mother had driven him insane, and although what he was doing was terrible, you still sympathized with him. And that was the character that Tony had created in the first one. And it was how to take that to the next level in the sequel. That was my feeling about what it should accomplish dramatically. And it was
go ahead. I'm sorry, sir.
No, please go ahead.
So that was how you kind of established that sympathy for the character by establishing a kind of subplot to work against Norman, work against his efforts to rehabilitate?
What I'm saying was what you saw working in the first movie in Psycho, made among the many things that made it stunning was that Norman Bates was a sympathetic psychopathic murderer. And I'm not even saying that was because of the screenplay. It was, yes, the screenplay, yes, but it was really what Tony did with the character.
Absolutely.
And so, therefore, that was the character that you wanted to see in the sequel. And realizing that dramatically, that was how I pitched the story to the director, Richard Franklin, and got the job. So now how to accomplish that was something else. The underlying premise of Psycho 2 was that you have a psychopath who's been rehabilitated and has been... let back into society, and what's sympathetic about it is he's desperately trying to hold on to his insanity, to his sanity, and
right.
The relatives of his previous victims are not happy or feel that justice has been betrayed, and they decide to drive him mad, so they can put him back in the insane asylum, and of course it backfires. But the sympathy for Norman is that even as Norman's grasp on sanity begins to loosen, he's desperately trying to hold on to it.
You still so desperately want to cheer for him, to pull through.
It was always I don't know whether the right word is irony or the duality,
mm-hmm.
but it was always part of what made Norman Bates such a fascinating character. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, were you a presence on the set during shooting of that film?
Yeah, I was.
What are some of your fond memories of that particular set?
Well, it was just a terrific experience. It was a happy film. I just recently going through my through the memorabilia I have, I came across the whole bunch of Polaroids. Does anybody even know what a Polaroid is anymore, I wonder?
Yeah, that's funny. They don't make them anymore.
I know. But I tell you, the quality wasn't good. I hadn't looked at them in 27 years or however long it's been, and there were Polaroids of on the set. And with myself and Robert Loggia clowning with the knife sticking out of Robert Loggia. And
he has one of the great death scenes in the whole film.
It's terrific! Yeah.
Was that in the script? The hitting the banister and the knife going in further, or was that obviously something? Or is that something that like let's do it a little more and really kind of stick it to the audience with that?
That was all in the script. That was probably the closest writing experience I've ever had with a director,
mm-hmm.
where not only did I wrote it, but then we looked at the mise-en-scène or the visual set pieces, whatever you want to call them, and I wrote them, too. We felt that we had to, and this sounds gratuitous, but we felt that we had to give a certain amount of what in those days was gore, I guess, and among those, what you're talking about is he falls, and there's a close-up as he hits the floor and drives a knife further through his body. Right. Also, in that category would be the knife going through Vera Miles' throat and out the back of her head.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
But the times changed since 1960, didn't they?
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting discussion too.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But there was no question that was the direction that you wanted to go to appeal to a more modern audience.
Well, yes, but they were touches, and there were three
right.
or four of them. They were Norman grabbing the knife that Meg Tilly is wielding, trying to hold him back.
Right, right.
And they pull the knife through his bare hands. That was a scream. But those shots, we deliberately added those shots, and I can't remember, five or six different places now. And I wrote them into the script. Yes.
Well, Hitchcock did the same thing. I mean, back in 1960, what Hitchcock did, those five or six shock moments he put in his Psycho. I mean, they must have been equally as terrifying and as shocking back then as they were in Psycho 2 in
83. You can count on it. Richard Franklin, the director of Psycho 2, was a devotee and a student of Hitchcock, and had gone to visit him at Universal when Richard was at USC. So I mean, they're the whole film is a homage to Hitchcock. There is a pan around Mother's bedroom, and if you look carefully, you'll see a silhouette of Alfred Hitchcock on the wall.
I saw that. Yes,
because we wanted Hitchcock to make an appearance in the film, as he did in all of his films.
Tell me about Richard Franklin, because obviously this was a collaboration that worked, and because you guys did it again. Tell me about that collaboration.
Richard Franklin was an Australian. Mm-hmm. As I said, he went to USC.
Mm-hmm.
He was at the vanguard of the Australian film movement at the time. He was probably one of the few Australians doing overtly commercial films. He did a film called Rogue Games and another film called Patrick, mm-hmm. both of which echo Hitchcock. It's how he got the job, actually, I think.
Rogue Games, for sure. Definitely.
Yeah. He was a very, very nice fellow. He was dry. He had an academic personality. He's now passed away, but he was teaching at the university in Sydney, I think, and I can't remember the name of the university, but he was teaching film. I mean, he worked, you know, throughout his life, but he also taught. He educated me in Hitchcock. I remember him giving me books of criticism. Robin Wood, I think.
Oh, yeah. Great.
Yeah,
book.
You know, which I think was the critic that he respected most of Hitchcock's films. We dissected together. We ran, I don't know how many of Hitchcock's films, and those were in the days when VHS cassettes had just come out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we would take things. I can't remember all. Certainly, obviously, Psycho, but a lot of all the other Hitchcock films. Some very, ones lesser known. Like,
right.
I believe, not The Lodger, which is famous, but like Blackmail, which was the first sound film done in England. I believe it was shot in 1929 or 30, and Hitchcock directed that. By the way, Ronnie Neim was the first AD on that, if you really want to get into minutiae.
Right.
Ronnie Neim directed the first Poseidon Adventure.
Right.
So that was a group around Hitchcock. So Richard and I dissected the action set pieces or mise en scène or whatever you want to call of Alfred Hitchcock as we did the film, and then we built the visual set pieces in once we had the dramatic framework and a scene by scene breakdown.
Right. And you know,
it was a very meticulously planned film.
Yeah. I've been watching these past couple of weeks. I've been going back through old interviews with Mr. Perkins, and he always seemed the common question was, don't you feel typecast with this iconic character? And he always seemed to feel quite the opposite. He seemed to relish in being able to bring this character to audiences. What was your experience working with him and just observing him work?
He was brilliant. I mean, I don't know if I can say that about any other. I don't say that about very many other people, actors or otherwise. But Tony Perkins was brilliant. I mean, his best friend was Stephen Sondheim, I believe. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of the film business and who did what. There was a game back in those days, which they still may play, the movie game. You name a star, and you name a star. I name a movie that star was in. Now you have to name another actor that was in that movie, and you keep the chain going until you lose.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Tony could play it with cinematographers, composers, the directors. I mean, he knew everybody who was creatively important, and it seemed to me like every film ever made, films like Three Jills in a Jeep from 1941,
Right.
I mean, stuff that you'd never heard of. Now today, that would be impossible, probably with the onset of so many DVD movies. But in those days, even in the early 80s, you still were dealing mainly with classic, what we call classic cinema now.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had that. He also had that about music, about classical music, about opera. I mean, it was an encyclopedic knowledge of high culture. He was high culture. He was not lowbrow. He was highbrow.
It's sad when a mother has to speak the words that condemn her own son. But I couldn't allow them to believe that I would commit murder. They'll put him away now, as I should have years ago. He was always bad. And in the end, he intended to tell them I killed those girls and that man. As if I could do anything except just sit and stare, like one of his stuffed birds. Oh, they know I can't even move a finger, and I won't. I'll just sit here and be quiet, just in case they do suspect me. They're probably watching me. Well, let them. Let them see what kind of a person I am. I'm not even going to swat that fly. I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know. And they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
Stephen Rebello. He's an accomplished writer and screenwriter, and his articles and interviews have appeared in the pages of GQ, Playboy, the LA Times, Movie Line, and dozens of additional prestigious publications. His books include Real Art, Great Posters from the Golden Age of the Silver Screen, Bad Movies We Love, and Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho, a chronicle that film critic Richard Schickel called one of the best accounts of the making of an individual movie we've ever had. Now that book is being made into a feature film for which Rebello will serve as screenwriter and executive producer. And we do talk about that a little bit towards the end of this interview. Here's Mr. Rebello to tell us all about his relationship with Hitchcock and his deep insight into Hitch's creative process, as well as the risky project that would become one of Mr. Hitchcock's most revered classics. Here's Stephen. I read that you went to school, you studied literature and clinical psychology, if I understand correctly.
I double majored, yeah.
Yeah. Did those two complement one another for you?
Not, well, that wasn't apparent at first, but I mean, I actually did pursue a career in clinical psychology, and I actually was a therapist for about 10 years in Boston. I was at a Harvard teaching hospital, and but always on the side I was writing. I figured I needed to figure out a way to make a living that I really liked, and you know, I'm endlessly fascinated by people, and so I did that and was very successful at it, and it was very gratifying for me. But as I was saying, all the time during that, I was writing and, you know, getting things published, and then finally I decided to, you know, make a break and actually pursue writing full time, and it was actually Hitchcock who helped me do that.
And that was your first meeting with him, I believe, was your last year at Harvard, is that correct?
Well, I have a strange history with Mr. Hitchcock. He is always Mr. Hitchcock to me, except when I'm writing the screenplay version of the book, and then he becomes someone very different from Mr. Hitchcock. But I do think of him as Mr. Hitchcock. When I was a kid, I grew up in southern New England in Massachusetts, and very poor parents, very wonderful parents, but you know, we didn't have a lot of money. But my mother would come home from work, and I'd be talking. I'm not joking. I'd be talking to Alfred Hitchcock on the phone. I'd call him.
No kidding.
He would take the calls. Not so weird. If you know me, it's not so weird that I would call him. I tend to be fearless, at least on the surface. But pretty remarkable in the fact that he would take phone calls, as did, by the way, William Castle, his rival. But, we had a couple of very childlike on my part, but, very lovely conversations. And I met him actually at the premiere of Torn Curtain, which took place, the world premiere of Torn Curtain happened to take place in Boston. And, I didn't drive then, but a friend of mine drove me to the premiere. I remember it was 10 o'clock in the morning. There were actually pictures of me that appeared in newspapers. But anyway, there was a mob. It was a public premiere. And there really were a mob of people. It was in a very beautiful movie, a true movie palace, in the grand old style, the music hall in Boston. And they rolled out a 50-layer cake with the titles of all of Mr. Hitchcock's movies, with Torn Curtain being on top. And then he climbed up a little ladder, and I always loved that there were quite beautiful women dressed as French maids. and they sort of rolled out the cake and Mr. Hitchcock climb the ladder and cut the layers. And everyone in the theory was that everyone in the lobby would get a slice of cake. I was not interested in cake. My mother made very good cake. What I needed was to let Mr. Hitchcock know that the guy, the little kid who was stalking him on the phone, was in the house. So I, probably about 1,000 people in the lobby. It's that grand a lobby. I said to my friend Richard, who was standing next to me, we were in the back, and I said, I'm going to go talk to Mr. Hitchcock now. And it was like the crowd parted, like the Red Sea. I just walked straight through and put up my hand, and we had a lovely little conversation. I had a little, one of the very first books that I can remember about Hitchcock was written by a Brit, a man named George Perry. And I had a copy of that book. And I asked Mr. Hitchcock if he would sign it. Not only did he sign it, he did his little famous silhouette. And then I always loved it. Everyone started rushing him after we were through, asking him to sign something or other, and asking for the silhouette. And he said in a very imperious voice, "That's all I give." And he was done.
Right.
But it was that was a lovely experience. And he remembered that our conversations. And I asked him what film he was going to do next, and at that time he told me that it was Kaleidoscope, which he never got to make, thanks to Lou Wasserman and company. But anyway, I have an odd history with Hitchcock. And then, when I was at Harvard, I just started classes as a freshman year. I never completed classes because of Hitchcock, actually. But I was on vacation, and I was in Los Angeles and with a group of friends, and they asked me what I would like to do while I was out, during my semester break, and I don't sit still very easily. And I said, I'd like to interview somebody while I'm out here. And they said, well, who? I said, well, I think Alfred Hitchcock would be interesting. And I'm not kidding, Jamie. It sounds like I'm making this up, but right on cue, someone in the room said, his telephone number is, and rattled it off. And he knew that because he worked for, this person worked for Cary Grant, and it was his responsibility to be kind of like Mr. Memory in the 39 Steps. Only he had to know everything and phone numbers. And so if Cary Grant wanted to call Hitch, as he called him, then this guy would yell out phone number. You know, it was... So it seems I don't want to say fated, but it sounds, my connections with Hitchcock are really very, well, I'm blessed by them, but they're very odd and almost preordained, and I can't quite figure it out. When I interviewed him, it was the Harvard imprint that, Harvard University imprint that impressed him. Which I completely understood, and I was so lucky to get the time, but they had said that I could have 20 minutes, which I was excited and grateful for. He gave me an hour. I was well over an hour, actually, about an hour and 20 minutes. We just hit it off so much so that he actually spent part of the last phase of the interview telling me what I should dress, how I should dress, and what colors I should wear. And I mean, he couldn't resist this. I mean, this is just the way he was. He wanted people to be, aesthetically pleasing in every way, and he knew everything there was to know about color and design and cut of fabric and tooth and all of that. And he was, I wasn't offended. I was honored. I mean, that he was so willing to share. I mean, it's a hilarious thing to do. I mean, I've obviously interviewed many, many people since then, and no one's given me wardrobe pointers.
But he was giving you direction.
He was giving me direction. Well, he was also, he was pretty great because they sat me in the, they sat me in this lovely, very British-looking waiting room that was, part of his suite of offices, and I was going to take a certain chair, but his assistant, I think it was Suzanne Gauthier, asked me to sit in a specific chair, which I thought, okay, that's really controlling. I mean, it's a really nice Morris chair, very elegant wing-back kind of Morris chair. But then I realized why, because as I was sitting there, they opened the door just a crack, just enough for me to see Hitchcock swathed in a big white sheet with his neck back as his barber, Tony, had a straight-edge razor over him. It was like a tableau out of Sweeney Todd.
And wow.
Just enough time for me to see that, and then the door closed. You know, and then it was, I mean, it was so beautifully stage managed, you know.
Wow.
It was really quite wonderful.
So your appreciation of his films must have taken hold at a pretty early age for you.
Yeah, very early. My parents were big movie fans, and I can remember them. I have a very... I am very gifted with a very, very strong memory, and I can remember as a very, very young kid, someone who would have no right to remember any of this. I can remember being in the back seat of my dad's Oldsmobile at a drive-in movie theater. That's how long ago it was. Mm-hmm. And the film was The Man Who Knew Too Much, the Doris Day James Stewart version, of course.
Right.
And I have no right to remember this, but I think... Here's what I think happened. I remembered it so vividly. It had a very, very, very big impact on me. My dad was very tall and had a stammer and was thin and wore suits and fedora hats. My mother was very beautiful and blonde, and I thought she looked like Doris Day. So the fact that this little boy in the film, the kid Hank, whom I resembled as a kid, I think somehow it wasn't a movie for me. It looked like home movies to me. And so the fact that this little boy was being kidnapped and that his mother, who had a beautiful voice, as my mother had a beautiful voice, was a singer. And I somehow, like I say, the only way I can put it is that it wasn't a movie. It was as if I were watching home movies as a vacation we took that went horribly wrong. So, I really remember that. But honestly, it didn't, Hitchcock movies did not click in for me until Psycho, but really they clicked in with The Birth, because then I was old enough to, I was old enough to get it more fully. I mean, I do remember watching the Hitchcock TV shows, but I don't think I really understood them. I just pretended I did.
Right.
So I could be
right.
I could be precocious, and I thought the women were really pretty. But I always found him a charming, interesting, bizarre, macabre figure, and an unlikely TV host. And I think just something about his nature, reminded me of something out of Charles Dickens. And so I was. It's like Hitchcock came at me from different angles,
mm-hmm.
and then finally, finally the thing all sort of came together and continues to come together as this feature film version of Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho is really now finally taking shape, and I'm an executive producer and screenwriter on it. So the Hitchcock thing just continues and continues.
But when you met Hitchcock and spent time with him, what did you want to know from him? What were those burning questions you had for him?
Well, what was happening was I was going to do a story for the Harvard Crimson, which I subsequently didn't do. So it was going to be a newspaper article, and it was published in the Boston Phoenix, which was the alternative the paper in Boston in the end. To answer your question, the burning questions that I wanted to know, I mean, I really wanted to ask him and did, about motivations and what were behind specific movie choices and
mm-hmm.
Why did the camera move in certain ways and why were those women mostly blonde? And what about those recurring themes? And things like, I somehow even then I was aware that, I was very aware because I was, I'd been very, very interested in 70s movies and the big change in Hollywood and, the new women at the time in the 70s being, Julie Christie and Jane Fonda coming to the fore and Faye Dunaway and Peckinpah and all that great, I was obsessed, and I'm obsessed still with Altman, so all that stuff coming together, and I was really curious how Hitchcock planned, in what was 1980 when I interviewed him, planned to continue and planned to weather that, and how movies had changed, and how technology had changed, and how the star system had collapsed. So I was very interested in talking with him about the mechanisms of movies and how those had changed for him. That's what I was interested in. Hitchcock controlled interviews. He told you what he wanted to tell you.
Yeah.
And, and lots of what he talked about was, you push this button and this answer comes out. He had developed his press persona.
Well, that doesn't surprise me because we've, in previous shows that we've done, we just did something on Polanski's films.
Yeah,
we're covering Robert Altman this Sunday, actually. So I'm in love with Robert Altman as you are. They're not very reflective about meanings, motivations, themes in their work. So you got that sense from Mr. Hitchcock as well.
Oh, very, very clearly. And he was very much, I talk about him a lot in the present tense. I swear to you, I'm not Norma Desmond. I do know this is past. However, he looms so large as a figure. But let me answer that question, which is, I think that he was actually quite reflective as a filmmaker and as a person and as a philosopher. He wasn't deep intellectually, which is something that I gather not just from my really brief, conversations with him, but more from people around him who spend a lot of time around him. Nor did he spend a lot of time with collaborators who were intensely intellectual, that with some very notable exceptions, but he was also very very artfully dodging all of us in terms of his films, and I think that's part of the fascination. He is he seems so accessible and so relatable, as his films are, to many, many people in many cultures. And yet, many great artists, or the ones at least that fascinate me, he is deeply inscrutable. He is finally unknowable. And I think that keeps us going back again and again to the well. I mean, lots of directors and lots of writers borrow Hitchcock tropes, but they don't get the underneath. Because maybe it's impossible to do that. But
yeah.
What they're not getting is, you can set up a camera angle, you can set up lighting, you can costume people in a certain way, but the deepest logic, the deepest emotional logic that was Hitchcock is finally his alone.
Not a lot of people believed in Psycho from the studio side. There was a lot of questioning as to why someone of Hitchcock's stature would choose such quote-unquote unsophisticated material. But looking back, do you find that that's probably his most influential movie of his career?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I'm going to take the studio viewpoint for like 22 seconds, which is Paramount was angry with Hitchcock at this point. He'd made some very successful movies for them during the early part of his contract. Certainly The Man Who Knew Too Much made a lot of money, To Catch a Thief, a big hit, A Rear Window. But when Hitch wanted to vary off the beaten path, or what Paramount saw as the beaten path, they took it in the neck. Trouble with Harry, for example, a movie that I love, didn't make any money. Vertigo, a movie that I worship, didn't make any money. North by Northwest, Hitchcock made for MGM, made a lot of money in 1959. So they were not happy with him, and they were second-guessing him, and his contract with them was ending. You know, he was also getting older by Hollywood standards. You know, he was in his late 50s, so more second-guessing. And, you know, Hitch was pretty imperious. I mean, they gave him the money, and he would do the movie that he wanted to make, and Paramount would have to like it or not like it, or promote it or not promote it. So I think Psycho came at a very important time for Hitchcock, when he knew the walls were closing in, when he knew that other directors were being compared to him. He felt that he needed to reinvent himself, that he needed to do something very different, and Paramount didn't want to go on that journey with him. They thought, as you said, it was unsophisticated. It was smutty. They thought it was cheap and vulgar. And so, in fact, as you know, Jamie, so did many of the people around Hitchcock who told him, don't make this movie. Lou Wasserman didn't want him to make the movie, and, you know, Lou Wasserman had been his agent and a father confessor. Herb Coleman, who was assistant director and a close, you know, personal friend as well as a collaborator, pretty much left Hitchcock's circle because of Psycho. So everybody knew that it wasn't a movie that he should make except for Hitchcock. So he knew that there was. I think that he was prescient. I think that he knew that the writing was on the wall for him, that he needed to come up with something entirely new. I think he saw that the times, they were changing, that audiences were way ahead of, as they usually are, of movie studios in terms of what they could quote unquote take in the way of violence, in the way of adult sexuality, in the way of language. So, you know, first time out, the screenplay, or at least the first Joseph Stefano screenplay with Hitchcock for Psycho. You know, there was a previous draft by another writer, but Joe Stefano's first script, which was pretty much what was filmed, was pretty bold. I mean, I'll take the pretty off it. It was bold. It was bold in language. It was bold in implication and innuendo. You know, in those days, audiences got innuendo, and Hitchcock knew it. I mean, that's one of the reasons why he liked to withhold and to titillate and to tease you, because your imagination and your own dirty mind or your own sense of fear and terror usually are stronger than what anyone can convey. So, I think that Hitch thought the movie was a cakewalk, that it was something that he could do relatively quickly, relatively inexpensively, and if it didn't work, cut it for TV, cut it down to an hour, show it on television, move on to the next. And the hunter got captured by the game. I mean, it did turn out to be a hugely profitable movie for him. It did become the movie that people associated with him, and it's a very atypical, in many ways, Hitchcock movie.
It is.
And then, so to get himself out of one trap, that is, I'm getting too old, people know what to expect of me, I need to come up with something different, he came up with something that was so different in certain ways that he created another trap, which is, how do I top it? How do I frighten people in different ways? Or how do I not frighten people? And audiences and many audience members, as the box office receipts of his subsequent movies showed, never forgave him for not delivering another Psycho. So it's a one-off, this movie, in many ways, and yet it defines him.
It was so revolutionary, and it dealt with several kind of taboo subjects, and it was such a visceral experience. When I think of Psycho, I always try to imagine the audience is pouring in to see it for the first time in the year it was released. 1960, was it?
Yes, 1960. Summertime.
And what their reaction had to have been?
Unbelievable. It was one of the biggest sucker punches in the history of cinema. People didn't know what to expect. They knew what to expect considering it was Hitchcock. They, especially from the TV show, he'd become so widely known. But just think of context. Think of North by Northwest. I mean, just movie context. Think of Vertigo. You know, think of Trouble with Harry. Think of the movies that preceded it, with the exception of The Wrong Man, which is black and white and grim and French in certain ways. But they just didn't know what to expect. Didn't know what hit them. I was there. I saw it happen. Again, I was too young to really understand what was happening. But I can tell you this. I remember one of the most satisfying things in my life was seeing one of my school teachers run up the aisle covering her mouth in sheer terror. And
wow.
That was really triumphant for a kid to see a school teacher reduced to a puddle. But,
it's triumphant for me right now just hearing about it.
Okay, well, I'm here to help. So, but I have to tell you, Jamie, I can, and you know, memory is always gilded, but I can remember the sound, I can remember certain sounds in my life, but one of the strongest was I can remember men screaming. And not the kind of screaming that you hear now at Paranormal Activity or, you know, fill in the blank. Where, you know, guys are showing off for each other or their dates, you know, or they're just goofing. No, I remember screams being ripped out of guys' throats. I came from a very working class community in southeastern Massachusetts, a mill town, when America actually had industries and we made things. And this was a town full of cotton mills. And my parents and family members worked in those mills, the textile mills. So there was a lot of immigrant population too. So what I'm setting up here is a very macho culture, Portuguese Americans, Lebanese, workers,
right.
not college grads, not effete snobs. I mean, salt of the earth, working class people. So to hear guys that worked with my father on the night shift scream, that's not something you forget very soon. I can also remember, Jamie, being in the back seat of, once again, another back seat story, but a back seat of my mother's car when she picked up a friend of hers, Betty. Betty, well, I shouldn't say her last name, but who had already seen Psycho. My mom hadn't seen it. And I had to sneak in to see it. I wasn't allowed to see it, but off I went. But Betty they were talking about Psycho, and my mother said, "Well, what is it?" And I remember this distinctly. My mom's friend Betty leaned into her ear and said, "It's about a queer. It's about
wow.
a queer." And because you didn't say that word aloud. Now, as it turned out, Betty didn't quite get the story correctly. Because Psycho is not about a queer. It's about a queer guy, but not about a queer. But that's how it rattled people. They didn't even know what it was about. All they knew was that it was about things you weren't supposed to talk about, like transvestism and you know, men wearing women's clothing or wanting to become their mothers. I mean, you have to remember that this was just a few years past Christine Jorgensen, the first a GI who had the sex change in Denmark. So there's a lot of repression during this time and a lot of things unspoken. I mean, if you think Mad Men is fantasy land, I can tell you that it isn't, because it wasn't. So, Psycho hit a world unprepared. They were sort of unprepared. Let me put it this way. They didn't know what they were in for, but they knew they were ready for something bolder and stranger and darker.
Yeah. And that's what hit them.
And it had to have been one of the... Yeah, I'm sorry. It had been one of those movies, equating it with a film, and from my childhood, even though I didn't see this when I was very young, but a film like Scarface, which is so in your face, it kind of punches you in the gut, as you said about Psycho, and you don't realize the other layers to the film. I didn't realize until years later when I rewatched it several times, this is actually a funny film and has a lot of funny moments in it. And there's a lot of kind of subversive humor I find in Psycho that had to have been lost on them from the shock of first seeing it.
Well, I can tell you, yeah, I mean, great comment. I mean, I can remember seeing films after Psycho that didn't have the same impact on me, but had visceral impact on me. For example,
right.
Bonnie and Clyde. For example, The Wild Bunch. Those movies left me shaken in terms of violence, use of humor, juxtaposed with violence, brilliance of editing technique, brilliance of form and use of music, and the whole plastic of cinema. But certainly Hitchcock intended the film Psycho to be very darkly funny. He thought it was hilarious. He told me that how funny he thought the movie was. But I honestly think that he didn't know exactly how funny until he did see it with an audience. Because Anthony Perkins told me about being at several screenings that he... I don't mean studio screenings. I mean theater showings, where people were laughing, really laughing, not at it, but they were laughing out of nervousness.
Yes.
They certainly laughed. If you remember the moment when Norman Bates is walking up the stairs and his hips are swaying from side to side, in my community, that got roars of laughter. They got it. Lines like, Mother isn't quite herself. Those are things that you're like Scarface. You need other viewings to let that stuff really work on you. But certainly Hitchcock and Joseph Stefano, the screenwriter, layered all that in, and they were both very sardonic, funny. In Stefano's case, I would say very hip, New York witty, glib kind of guy. So, those things were all intended, but it really takes the alchemy of a movie, its time, what's going on in the world, context, and that dialogue with an audience to let you as a filmmaker know just how funny or scary or dull or whatever it is your movie
mm-hmm.
is. So Hitchcock learned a lot with Psycho, but let's remember, Jamie, that he thought about hiring a psychologist and a psychiatrist to do testing and figure out what made Psycho work, because he wanted to do it again, or he wanted to do something again that might allow him to play the audience like an organ.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, he was cheap, and he didn't want to spend the money, and he probably figured, look, it's not going to work anyway. No one's ever going to be able to really tell me, why it worked and why it didn't. It's part,
right.
of part of the zeitgeist. But I do want to say as an aside that here's something that I think lots of people don't know, but it's pretty brilliant. One of the men that he wanted to hire, one of the doctors that he wanted to hire as the expert to tell him why Psycho worked with audiences, and he was going to pay him a lot of money to do this, was in fact one of the doctors who on television and in the press was railing against Hitchcock and Psycho and wanted it banned, and said what a destructive movie it was and how it was leading to real-life violence. So Hitchcock, in a way, was wanting to buy this guy off. and from what I understand is how he finally bought him off so that he didn't have to pay for the survey was he agreed to do a kind of duel with him in an interview for a then-popular magazine called Red Book, which got the doctor a lot of attention, got Psycho a lot of attention, got Hitchcock a lot of attention, and then meant that he made a friend out of an enemy.
Mm.
So he was a brilliant guy at co-opting people.
I think of Anthony Perkins in the film, and it's one of those perfect performances. It's everything. It's funny, it's awkward, it's vulnerable and heartbreaking and frightening. It's everything. And I'm wondering what Hitchcock's, what his view was of Perkins' contribution to that film, because when I read quotes from him concerning the film, he always singles out Herman for being so instrumental in the success of that film. But I don't necessarily read him speaking about Perkins.
Another good question. Hitchcock used to say that if he could get 80% of his original vision, then he was lucky. He also said that casting is 90% of the process, and 90% of whether the movie will work or it won't. Now, he was brilliant in casting Anthony Perkins in many ways. Perkins owed Paramount a movie, and so he could be gotten really inexpensively. Perkins was unhappy with what Paramount was doing with him. You have to remember, this guy was being built up as the next James Dean,
mm-hmm.
slash James Stewart. So lots of money was being put into Anthony Perkins to create him into the image of a movie star. Now, Hitchcock also knew about, because Hitchcock was a great gossip, I can attest to that, because he gave me some. He loved gossip, and he knew everything about the personal life of actors. And he knew a great deal about the personal life, or the rumored personal life, of Anthony Perkins. And he knew, or he thought he knew, that playing Norman Bates would be a huge risk for any actor. But particularly then, for an actor who was being given the big build-up, and about whom all these whispers were around town. That he was, if not gay, then bi. And but in those days, really, the rumors were that he was bi, and many people knew he had a relationship with another film star, a big heartthrob at the time, Tab Hunter. So
yeah.
It was kind of brilliant casting in many ways. I'm eliminating or not stressing the fact that Perkins, given the right material, was a phenomenal actor. And he had really good material he had a really good script, and he had really good raw material. Hitchcock was enormously grateful to Perkins, as he should be. He sent him a telegram when he was not nominated for an Academy Award that he was ashamed of his fellow actors.
Mm.
That's a very big, generous gesture on Hitchcock's part, who took most of the credit for everything. And rarely gave actors credit. He loved Anthony Perkins. He spent a lot of time with him. He played word games with him on the set. He liked Janet Leigh, and he liked Perkins, and he was cruel and dismissive of Vera Miles and John Gavin. Perkins and Janet Leigh were the favorite kids. He loved that Perkins came up with the idea of chewing candy corn in the movie. He loved that Perkins and Martin Balsam had worked out that wonderful interrogation scene where they overlapped dialogue, where they because they shot it straight. They shot it less sort of off the cuff and more the script. But he had such respect. We had great respect for Martin Balsam. But he had such respect for Anthony Perkins that he let them try it their way, and those are the takes that he used, and it caused a lot of problems in terms of editing and looping and all of that. But he didn't care because the spontaneity of the scene was so electric. So
was that unusual for him? Because when I think of Hitchcock, his films seem to be so tightly controlled. Was allowing for that kind of spontaneity unusual for him, or was that par for the course?
It wasn't par for the course, really. But when he really respected the actor and trusted the actor and knew they could do it, he would let someone like James Stewart or Cary Grant or Anthony Perkins play. And they played so naturally to their own strengths as screen personae, and always within the framework of the character, that he knew that he could relax and just let them fly. Now, his movies were, as you say, they were really mapped out, storyboarded. All camera angles were worked out in advance. Although that, you know, that's kind of a canard too, because he was open to experimentation and improvisation. It, you know, if someone he respected had a better idea, he'd listen. Not only would he listen, he would do it. He had great respect for Janet Leigh. He really liked her a great deal. And, you know, he basically told her, look, as long as you are in the place that I need you to be, that is the physical place that I need you to be when my camera moves from here to here or that I cut to you, then you can do whatever you want within that frame. And, you know, that may sound to some people very controlling. For some actors, like Janet Leigh, who told me this again and again, she loved it. Because she had Janet's MO when she got any script, particularly the Psycho script, was she would write a complete history of the character from birth, and she shared that with Hitchcock and with Mrs. Hitchcock, and they loved it. She knew what perfume Marion Crane would wear. She knew what books and magazines she would read, what she would subscribe to, what record albums. How's that for archaic reference, but she knew what record albums would be in her collection. See, and so Hitchcock and Alma, who was his right-hand person, knew that someone like Janet could be trusted. She had thought it out. That's all he ever wanted to know. Have you really thought this through? And if they had, and if they had come to him, already from a place of competence and wisdom and charisma and all of that, he would just let them go with it. So yes and no is the answer to your question.
Now, your film. Let's talk a little bit about your film. I know I've been reading about this for years, and I understand you've it's a long process, I know. Where are we with this now, with the film?
You know, well after a writer's strike, an actor's strike, a director who worked on it beautifully for a year, and then just got too busy with other things. We're back on track, and the financing is in place. We have our leading man and suggestion of a leading woman. We've got, it's kind of an embarrassment, Jamie, really, with the numbers of really great actors who've wanted to step up and play Janet Leigh. And Vera Miles and John Gavin, and the tough one is really Anthony Perkins.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very tough role to cast, but it's going to be surprising to people. I don't think people know what movie it's going to be. I think there are some people who call me or contact me or write me and want to know how the documentary is going. It's not a documentary. I mean, it's a feature film, and it's I think it's going to surprise people. I think it's I think the simplest way for me to say it is basically a film about Mr. and Mrs. Hitchcock as they're making Psycho, and how their relationship is influencing the movie as it's being shot, and how the film is influencing their relationship.
That's exactly the movie I want to see. What you're describing. So that sounds amazing. Now, so you're in search of a director now?
There are conversations ongoing with directors. Once again, we have been bombarded with directors who want to do it. And it's kind of mind-boggling. I mean, it really is. I'm not being, like, faux modest here.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah.
Well, see, that surprises me, Jamie, because Hitchcock is tough, and there are, I would think that there would be some directors who would shy away because, oh my God, are people going to expect a Hitchcock movie that is going to be like a Hitchcock movie or look mm-hmm. like or feel like a Hitchcock movie? And that's a tone and those are aesthetic decisions that, let me put it this way, certainly the screenplay as written would allow someone who wants to make a Hitchcockian movie do that. But I mean, we're talking about household names, directors that if you dream about would say, yeah, I want to do this movie. So it'll be interesting to see and I think the decision will finally be made within the next 4 weeks, how this is going to go. But, you know, lots of creative elements are already in place. But we have, and I have been adamant about this, deliberately been keeping things quiet. Off the IMDb,
right.
Off the Twitter, off the Facebook, off the everything, so that, you know, there can be some surprises for people.
I haven't been able to see it, no. I'm just going on buzz alone.
Well, you're in for quite a treat. It's a remarkable movie. So I'm very pleased and honored to be in the presence of filmmakers, because the people behind this company are movie makers. Tom Pollock used to run Universal, and he has impeccable aesthetic taste. So we are in brilliant hands, and the company does have relationships with film studios. Up in the air is Paramount. So I would really like it if this film were released by the studio that made Psycho. I think that would be sort of a nice aesthetic and creative kind of. It'd be charming, I would say.
I think so too. Yeah.
And I think it would be poetic justice in a strange kind of way. The studio that didn't want to make Psycho and made a fortune from it is now perhaps releasing the movie that is made about the making of Psycho.
Oh, that would be beautiful.
I appreciate the irony.
Yeah, so can you confirm Hopkins?
All that I can confirm, and as he stammers, all that I can confirm is that Mr. Anthony Hopkins has been attached to this project from the beginning and tells us he wants nothing more than for this movie to finally happen so that he can sink his teeth into this role.
Good enough. I have to fish for my scoop.
I completely understand.
But when this comes to fruition, come back and talk to us as much as you're comfortable talking to us about it. We'd love to have you back on.
Well, I'd love that. I had a really good time doing this. And, you know, when an actor would blossom under Hitchcock, it's not very much different. When an interviewee has an interviewer who is smart and listens and asks interesting questions, that allows you to come forth.
Thanks for joining us for Horror 101, Psycho. Join us tomorrow night for our next installment celebrating the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.